Good evening. I am Reverend Jeannie Lovelace. I am the interim senior pastor of First Congregational Church of Oakland, United Church of Christ. And it is our privilege to host you here in our holy sacred space this evening. It is a space that has been salted with tears and prayers and justice seeking. So it is an appropriate place to gather. So with that being said, I invite Emily has been the educator in our congregation about these issues. She has opened our eyes. She recently returned from Palestine. And it is with great joy that I give you Emily. She is a force to be reckoned with. I will not stand in her way.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's wonderful, wonderful to see you tonight. I hope you don't mind if I speak from up here. This is where I rehearsed. So, so I want to start the evening with a big shout out to First Congo, because Jeannie was too modest to mention it, but First Congo is donating our space here tonight as well as the staff. So let's hear it. And I also really want to thank Mecca, our co-sponsor, and I want you to be sure and check out the Mecca table in the lobby if you haven't already. So we've got a fantastic program tonight, and I know you are very eager to hear Dr. Kumsia, but I just want to tell you a couple of little words about Sabeel first, because tonight's event is a Sabeel fundraiser. The word Sabeel is Arabic for the way, and the organization Sabeel, we say we are the voice of the Palestinian Christians. And Sabeel is working for justice for all Palestinians within the framework of liberation theology. And Sabeel helped create the Kairos document, which is a very inspiring statement of faith, hope, and love. Our patron is Archbishop Desmond Tutu. You may have heard of him. And the Kairos document is a cry to all the world's Christians for help in fighting apartheid. And it is modeled on a similar document that was created by South African bishops in the 80s. And it is a very moving and inspiring spiritual foundation for what we do. And I hope you will get a copy of it while you're here tonight. We have them at our table. So here in the U.S., we are Friends of Sabeel North America, also known as FOSNA, and our mission is to support Palestine and work for peace with justice in the Holy Land through education and advocacy, as well as prayer. And we put on regional conferences around the country, and we have youth programs. And also, we sponsor witness trips to Palestine, and the photos you were seeing earlier, they were all taken on our the NorCal Sabeel group. We just got back from Palestine and the Holy Land, so those pictures are from that trip. Also, we have a public ad campaign going on, and we'll have more about this later because, as I mentioned, this is a fundraiser. So as a final note on Sabeel, I just want to add that Sabeel is on the Anti-Defamation League's top 10 list of dangerous organizations. Okay, now, about tonight's program. After Dr. Kumsia's presentation, we'll take questions from the floor, and then after that, he'll be available for book sales and signing right down front here. So, now, it is my honor to introduce our guest, And I asked him how he would like to be introduced, and he said, well, just two words, troublemaker. That's got it covered. Dr. Kumsia lives in occupied Palestine, and he is the founder and president of the Palestine Center for Rapprochement Between Peoples. And he's coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements in Beit Sahur. And in his spare time, he teaches at Bethlehem University and Brezet University. He's a distinguished geneticist who has taught at the University of Tennessee, Duke, and Yale. He's the author of many articles and the book Sharing the Land of Canaan, and of course, the newly released Popular Resistance in Palestine. So everyone, please welcome me. Join me in welcoming Dr. Kumsia.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming on a beautiful day to hear me here. And thanks for this church for hosting us, and certainly for Sabil for the wonderful work that they do. And it seems that I'm now a featured Sabil speaker. It seems that I come to a lot of regional Sabil conferences, and most recently in Bethlehem at the International Sabil Conference. It is also, during these events, the most rewarding thing for me, of course, is to see people I haven't seen in a while, and I didn't expect to see people here like Ziad and Jenka and Saeed and many others. Saeed, by the way, where is Saeed? there he is. He's in my book. If you want to read about him, he's in my book. Just look in the index. I obviously want to focus on the issue of popular resistance, but I had a major advisor who told me, when you give a talk, you need to tell your audience what you're going to tell them, then tell it to them, and then in the end, tell them what you just told them. And that way they'll remember it. So I will tell you briefly what I'm going to tell you, which is that the positive energy, the power of people, which is spreading and growing, is always, will be, the end result will be triumphing over the power of the state, authorities, colonization, whatever you want to call them. The positive energy of the people is a people's history. And we human beings are very good at storytelling. That's our ancestors sat in these caves around fireplaces and they told stories. And we need to go back to that route of telling stories of people, stories of inspiring stories, really, of what these people have engaged in their history. This is what Howard Zinn calls a people history, as opposed to the official histories that are told. For example, this is the map of the 530 Palestinian villages and towns that were depopulated in the largest post-World War II ethnic cleansing since World War II. This remains still the largest refugee population in the world. 7 million of the 12 million Palestinians in the world are refugees or displaced people. I could go on like this on and on with facts and figures and numbers and things like that. But of course, what is more relevant to us as human beings is the real story of the real people who encounter these things. This picture, for example, here with this girl and this older gentleman, what is their story? What can we tell about them? Perhaps one of you could trace them back and write a whole book about this family and what they have encountered, stuff like that. In my book, I try to bring just a very few selected stories, like Saeed's stories, for example, of what happened to him. These are stories of what we call in Arabic sumud, stories. Sumud refers to persistence, resilience, strength of character, the ability to survive against all odds, against incredible challenges. These are the kinds of stories that I think we need to tell more of them. And my next book is actually going to be a more detailed book, which each chapter is going to be a story of a particular family or a human being, from these stories. In this book, which is limited, of course, to 300 pages and covers the history of Palestinian resistance, I was rather selective, and I would mention a line or two about each particular event in history that I wanted to highlight, because obviously of space limitation, because I was covering this very large historical era or period. Now, Palestinians, of course, suffered. I am not going to deny that we, as a people, have suffered a lot. As I said, we had the largest ethnic cleansing since World War II, remaining as 7 million refugees or displaced people around the world, home demolitions, massacres, tens of thousands of people massacred, civilians, in the course of this colonization project that was started in the 19th century. So we suffered indeed. But we also should not deny the fact that many of us prospered also and survived despite all these odds, despite these incredible stories of suffering and pain that we have encountered. For example, many of these refugees tried to go back to their homes and lands. Some of them were shot because first, when Israel was established, the first order for the Israeli military was to shoot anybody who tries to go back to their homes and villages or towns. But, thousands of Palestinians did succeed in going back to their villages and towns despite such unfair and unjust and certainly cruel and inhumane strategy. Now, of course, Israel was not satisfied with being created on this area, which is the 78% of Palestine that became the State of Israel in 1948. Israel went ahead and occupied the remaining areas, this area, the West Bank, and this area, the Gaza Strip. And in those areas, Israel proceeded to build colonial settlements, and there are now 500,000 Israeli Jewish settlers living inside the West Bank. This is a settlement that's near my home of Beit Sahur. The picture on the top shows what it looked like in 1997, and on the bottom what it looked like today. And if we look at the Bethlehem district today, you will see these settlements here, in blue all around Bethlehem district, taking up, controlling really 87% of the district land of Bethlehem. The 13% of the district land that remains in the middle is now increasingly being surrounded by checkpoints, high walls, fences, electrified wire fences, etc. Again, we can talk about this history of suffering, but I choose to also look at the positive aspects of what happened to these places. There are even villages like this village Al-Walaja, which I took a few of you when you came to Palestine to see, because this village is situated between the apartheid wall that Israel is building and between this green line, which is the ceasefire line of 1948 to 1967. These villages in the seam zone are actually even more threatened and are basically Israel doesn't want them there. They want to demolish these villages. Al-Walaja actually used to occupy a very large area. I'm going to skip a few slides because of the time constraints. Al-Walaja used to occupy all this area before 1948. In 1948, the people of Al-Walaja were ethnically cleansed with all the other Palestinians from those villages in what became the State of Israel. And what remained under their control is this small piece of land beyond the green line. In 1967, Israel occupied this area and proceeded to build these settlements like Gilo and Har Gilo. And these settlements are intended to expand, which will take over additional land of Al-Walaja. And now Israel is building a wall that will surround Al-Walaja with all sides, leaving a single exit, basically, or gate for Al-Walaja people to leave. Of the currently 22,000 people who come from Al-Walajah, most of them, more than 20,000, live in refugee camps in Jordan, in the West Bank, like Bethlehem, other places. Only 2,000, less than 2,000 people remain in this part that is now going to be an open-air prison, as you see in the picture on the bottom. Not only that, but of course, Israel is not happy about the pace of this process, because these villagers are still sitting there. The wall that Israel is building around their houses is intended to take their land, so they have no means of livelihood, and they will be forced to leave. And if they don't get the message, why, this might give them the message. 33 homes have already been demolished in Al-Walajah, and 88 homes have pending orders for home demolition, pending demolition orders. And just before we came on the house of Abu Nidal, who some of you visited with me when I took you over there, there is a signs on the garden and the trees that were hung on the trees. They didn't even have the courtesy of knocking on his door to deliver these orders that are written in Hebrew, that say that they are laying hands on additional land of Al-Walajah, including the land that's just in front of his house. They will build the wall in front of his house, and even the graves of his parents and grandparents will be on the other side of the apartheid wall that Israel is building around Al-Walajah. So, but again, you know, this is a description of the story. This is not a description of what the people feel. If you really want to know about what the people feel, you should come and visit and talk to these people. And when you talk to Abu Nidal, he will tell you that he is not giving up. He's going to stay in his house. And he said, I would rather die here on my land than anywhere else, so I'm sticking to this land. And here is Abu Nidal in the yellow shirt here. This is his neighbor Omar and two children of Omar, who are sitting in front of bulldozers that were uprooting olive trees between their two houses, between Abu Nidal's house and Omar's house. This is the kind of resistance that Palestinians have engaged in. This is what I wanted to focus on, is the issue of popular resistance. Now, before I do that, as I was sitting here on the chair and I was looking, I was also thinking, do these people really know, you all, know what we Palestinians have been fighting for 130 years precisely, because the first Zionist colony was started in 1880 in Palestine, 131 years. What is it that we Palestinians have been fighting for? Nowadays, of course, you hear confusing messages from some of our leaders about two-state solution, about one-state solution, about an Islamic state, about this, about that. But this is all new talk, chit-chat, I call it. It doesn't really get us anywhere. What's the average Palestinian in the street would tell you about Palestinian needs, and why did our ancestors die? Why did the ancestors and those refugees that I told you were killed trying to go back to their homes and lands? What were they calling for? Well, you know, what they were calling for, freedom right there, equality, justice, truth. This is what they were fighting for. Thank you for putting the signs for us, right? This is, in essence, what they were fighting for, right? They want justice. They want the right to return to their homes and lands, because that's justice, basically. They want equality, because we don't want, you know, somebody because of their particular religion to rule over us, Jews ruling over Christians and Muslims, or any other combination, if you want. And we were, you know, freedom. Freedom from what? Freedom from repression, from occupation, from colonization, from this 43 year of military occupation. The longest remaining military occupation in history today is the Israeli military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. This is amazing that the international community tolerates this. And of course, truth. We are fighting to tell the truth, to tell our stories. So I will tell you my little story as a Palestinian. You know, I am, you know, just an individual, one of those 12 million Palestinians. I was born in a small village called Beit Sahur, from which Saeed is also from. Beit Sahur is the shepherd's field. Actually, the words in Aramaic, Beit Sahur, refer to the house of those who stay up by night, obviously watching over their flocks. This is where I was born. I was born literally down the hill from the Church of Nativity. This is a town that traces its history. We have archaeology and everything that shows that we go back hundreds of years, and my ancestors are Nabataean Canaanites who spoke Aramaic. Aramaic is the language of Jesus. What did Jesus fight for, by the way? Isn't it the same four words? this is what it is about. Jesus was the first Palestinian martyr of nonviolent resistance, right? You know, he died doing, fighting for these things and fighting for them, not by violence, not by harming the other, but by speaking the truth, by challenging, by turning the tables in the temple. This is essentially nonviolent resistance. And he's a Palestinian because he was born in a land called Palestine. And he spoke Aramaic, which is the language that predates Arabic and Hebrew. Our alphabet, the Arabic alphabet and the Hebrew alphabets, both come as modified from the Aramaic alphabet in Palestine. Palestine is where the Arabic alphabet originates. Many Arabs don't know this. If you ask them, where did the Arabic alphabet come? Which geographic region? They would not know. We need to learn history. That's telling the truth. That's why the truth is there. We have to tell the truth of what transpired. Of course, some of us later changed, acquired religions as they came, different religions, be it the original monotheistic religion, which was not called Judaism, by the way. There is no such thing in 2000 or 3000 BC, 3000 years ago. It was not called Judaism. Judaism is a new term that came much later, and it's actually a corrupted term referring to people from Judea. So it was people of Judea, and people of Judea are actually people of different religions. Some of them were pagan, etc. But in any case, of course, Christianity came, and many people converted to Christianity from whatever previous religion they had. And later, about two or three centuries later, rabbinical Judaism came about, which was essentially a response to Christianity. And many people converted to that, and rabbinical Judaism was a missionary religion, just like Christianity, went around preaching this to the rest of the world, and many people in Europe converted to Judaism and became what's known as Ashkenazi Jews. And of course, in North Africa, many North African Berber people converted to Judaism. There was even a queen there that converted to Judaism. But anyway, and Christianity, of course, did the same thing, and Islam did the same thing, spread around. Many people converted to these religions. The problem is not in the religions, as I told in my sermon today. Yes, I gave a sermon this morning at another church. But what I said in this is that basically the problem is not with religions. It is with the dogmatic use of religions to connect it to political power. Something that Christians have done, for example, in the Crusades, where they said there's Christendom and Christianity is the source of power, what Mark Ellis calls Constantinian Christianity, as there are Constantinian Judaism, Mark Ellis says, which is Zionism, essentially political Zionism. So, in essence of the struggle here is not about religions, because obviously we are people of different religions who are struggling together against oppression in Palestine, as I'll show you in a minute. If Palestinians were struggling for these issues like freedom, justice, the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands, how did they do it? Well, they did it like everybody else. I'm sorry, we're not special. Some people think that they are special, but not Palestinians. We don't think we're special. We're just like the South Africans, like the Algerians, like the Indians under British rule, like any other people that are facing similar colonial powers. We struggled by using the same methods. What are these methods? Well, of course, they involved mostly nonviolent resistance. That's what most of these struggles involved. because that's what most people are capable of and are doing, and normally, by, for example, trying to cling to their lands, as these people in Al-Walaja are doing and have been doing for 62 years. To my knowledge, not one person from Al-Walaja, from the 22,000 people, even those living in refugee camps, not one of them have engaged in armed resistance against the State of Israel. And if you add up all the Palestinians who took up arms, which was much later in our struggle, against the State of Israel, they would still be a minuscule number compared to the total population that's engaged in nonviolent resistance. But of course, nonviolent resistance is not something that people will talk about in the Western mainstream media, because why? Because it contradicts their marketing strategy. A marketing strategy is that the Palestinians are bad, the Israelis are good, the Palestinians are attacking, the Israelis are defending themselves, and this justifies the ethnic cleansing, it justifies the colonization, it justifies everything. And this simple marketing message that they have would be contradicted if they talked about the reality of what's happening on the ground, for example, with nonviolent resistance. These are pictures from the village of Al-Araqib in the Negev. Al-Araqib is a small village, a Bedouin community in the Negev, one of the so-called unrecognized communities. Israel, when they ethnically cleansed most of us when it was created as a state, they were left holding the bag with some Palestinians, a few, a minority, 20%, who remained in their villages. And so Israel was not happy about this situation and made life hell for these 20% of people who remain by, for example, you know, denying them their agricultural lands, stripping them of their rights, everything. But, of course, you know, they didn't get the message. These people wanted to stay on their village lands. So Israel said, okay, half the villages will be recognized and half the villages are unrecognized villages of the ones that remain. What does that mean, unrecognized villages? It means they don't get water, they don't get electricity, they don't get roads, they don't get health care, they don't get education. And okay, if you want to stay in such horrible conditions, you're go ahead and stay. Now, of course, to the surprise of the Israeli military, many of these people stayed. Most of them, I would say. There's hardly any that decided to move to the so-called recognized villages. So Israel upped the pressure. And at one point, they were even using crop duster airplanes to poison their plants so that they have no reason to continue to live in that area, and they would have to move to the areas that are recognized that Israel wanted to consolidate them in. Ironically, in the Negev, they called these areas, the Israeli government called these areas that they want to consolidate them in. They said these are concentration areas for the Bedouin of the Negev. I don't know, you know, what they are thinking about when they call something a concentration area. But in any case, the Bedouins refused, even after all that happened to them. So in some cases, the Israeli authorities decided, we'll just demolish these houses. And Al-Araqib, one of those villages that was demolished, not once, not twice, not 10 times, 18 times, meaning that every time the Israeli authorities demolished a village, the villagers come back and rebuild their village, despite the fact that it's unrecognized and receives no services, etc., etc. This is an act that I call an empowering and hopeful act of popular resistance. These are the kinds of stories of these people that ought to be told in detail, much more detail than certainly I put in my book. In my book, I just put the highlights, basically. That's why I need to work on this next book. Take some selected story and tell them in more detail. So yes, even though we Palestinians have lost lands, as you see in this picture, and ended up in shrinking in smaller areas that are essentially like the Bantustans of South Africa, which were designated for the black people here, you see on the map on the right, we Palestinians are allowed to stay now in some areas in the Galilee, in the West Bank, in the Negev and in the Gaza Strip. Together, these areas are roughly 8.3% of our historic land of Palestine. 8.3% of the land on which 5.5 million Palestinians live now. But that's, that 5.5 million Palestinians is, again, 5.5 million stories. You know, my own story that I just told you, you know, or was told to you in my biography, that I lived in the U.S. I taught in at universities like Yale and Duke. And then me and my wife relocated back to Palestine 3 years ago. So I am one of those people who was now in the ghetto of Bethlehem, right? And this is just one tiny little story of millions of other similar stories. And you can certainly say a lot more. Every one of you, I'm sure, can also write their own life story. The Palestinians here, I met a few Palestinians. I have, you know, like, you know, many of the guys here can certainly write these stories. Now, why is it important for me to come to the U.S.? Why do I take 5 weeks away from Palestine, which is really burning a hole in my heart? Because I every day in Palestine, I say, why didn't I move to Palestine a little sooner than 3 years ago? And now I miss it so much. I don't know, maybe I'm missing the tear gas in the demonstrations. Maybe I'm addicted to it, I don't know. But really, why do I take the time to come and speak to you in this book tour? Actually, these publishers are not giving me much from the book sales. They have many stages, and they end up, actually, I ended up having to buy my book and contribute to the thing. So why do I do this? Why do I come here? Because this is very critical, that the American public, especially the American public, really know what is going on with their own money, with their own support. This quote from Haaretz, it's on the slide, illustrates how much we are responsible, we as American citizens. And this is the other nagging part of my conscience, is that I am also a U.S. citizen. And I pay taxes. And these taxes are used to kill people and to injure people and to ethnically cleanse people and to destroy houses and to uproot olive trees that are over 2,000 or 3,000 years old. This is what's happening using our support. And it's not just the financial support, as this quote suggests. It's the fact that the U.S. government actually shields Israel from international law, shields Israel from having to fulfill these 4 simple words of equality, you know, freedom, justice, truth. The latest, by the way, was the U.S. use of the veto power at the United Nations. I don't know if you have heard about that. The U.S. even vetoed its own language, the U.S. language that says that the settlements, Israeli settlements on the occupied Palestinian territories are illegitimate and an obstacle to peace. This is what Obama had said many times, what Secretary Hillary Clinton had said many times also, and yet they vetoed their own language, showing the hypocrisy of the U.S. foreign policy. The hypocrisy of U.S. foreign policy is also the fact that they support dictatorship while they speak about human rights. Most of these guys in this picture on the top, Arab leaders, so to speak, are dictators who are kept in power by U.S. direct support, U.S. direct support. Without U.S. support, many of these guys would not last in power one day. The latest hypocrisy was when Saudi Arabia invaded Bahrain with U.S. support. So, you know, a country invades another country and the U.S. supports it. Now, what did we do when Iraq invaded Kuwait? You all remember, right? We not only kicked them out of Kuwait with a war, but we also subjected them to sanctions that killed 1 million Iraqis, including 500,000 children, and then we came 11 years later and changed their government. Well, in this case, a friend of ours invades Bahrain, where the U.S. has a very large naval military base, where the 6th Fleet has headquarters, And we not only say, fine, go for it, we actually encouraged them and suggested that they do it to kill their own citizens, to kill their own civilian citizens in Bahrain. Fortunately, of course, two of these guys are already gone, this guy and this guy. And we are taking bets now. Yeah. You know, we should be happy about this. And hopefully all of them will be gone. You know, the only democratic part of the Arab world here really is Lebanon, in my humble opinion. There is no other. All of them are in power by power force of arms, that's all. And support from the U.S. and because they support Israel. That's essentially why they are in power, because they support Israel. Physically, they support Israel. Sometimes rhetorically, some of them, like Hafez Assad and now his son Bashar Assad, will say that, we support the Palestinian resistance, etc. But in reality, they do not. Otherwise, why don't they resist? Why don't they reclaim the Golan Heights or something like that? So once the people acquire power, of course, people will do amazing things. One note we should remember also when we look at these Arab leaders in Arab countries is that the borders of these countries were not drawn by us, the Arab people. It was drawn all by colonial powers. And many of these people were put in there on this divided area by the classic colonial idea of divide and conquer. We divide people into these countries, different states, so that we can continue to pit them against each other, so that we can continue to rule over them. But as I said, the one thing that authoritarian regimes, colonial powers, imperial powers, and all other repressive powers in history, the one thing that they all do the same thing always, and they always repeat the same mistake, and that is to underestimate the power of the people. They always do that, invariably, every one of them. Every one of them thinks that his people are not going to rise up and cannot win against their rule. And they are always invariably mistaken. They are always invariably, they underestimate the power of the people. This is in Egypt, of course. This is also in Egypt. You can see the power of the state on the right and the power of the people on the left. You know, the state may have a lot of weapons, and not just these water hoses, of course, but they have much more, and they can unleash a lot of weapons. But the power of the people, when it reaches these stages, cannot be stopped. And the only thing that stops people from reaching these stages, like 18 million people were out in Egypt in one day, which should be in the Guinness Book of World Records, the only thing that stops them is fear, right? So what we have to do as individuals is shed our fear. Once we shed our fear, there's nothing that can stop us from doing anything we want. And certainly not from getting those four words that are on the ceiling. And it starts with truth. We have to tell the truth to these tyrants that they are tyrants. First of all, we have to tell them, hey, you know, you're a tyrant, you're a butcher, you're a murderer. And this is against international law, and you're committing war crimes. This is the truth-telling, and not to fear the consequences of truth-telling. I think Jesus taught us that, right? This is in Benghazi in Libya. This is in Bahrain. And of course, in Palestine, we Palestinians have had a very, very long history of this, and we, you know, as I said, we're not special. We have resisted. But perhaps because we resisted very, very long time, and because we were faced with perhaps one of the most sophisticated colonial enterprises in human history, and you may be surprised at me saying this, but it is true, the British in India, the South African system, the French in Algeria were amateurs compared to the Zionists in Palestine. The Zionists in Palestine not only were much better funded, much better armed, but also much better prepared and much more thoughtful, much more articulate and more careful in planning long term, not just for the next 1 year or 5 years, but for the next 50 or 100 years. When Herzl met with his Zionist leaders in 1897, here's what he said. He said, You know, today we have built a Jewish state. It may not happen, in 10 years or 5 years, but certainly in 50 years we will have it. Sure enough, in 50 years, exactly on the spot, in 1947, the U.S., under pressure from the Zionists, pushed for the partition resolution in Palestine that helped establish a Jewish state in Palestine. Many of the settlements, like the one I showed you near my own town, were named even 50 and 70 years before they were established. The Zionists had that much forethought and that much planning going forward as to what they were planning to do. So having to face this incredible onslaught, incredible sophistication in using Western media, Western support, imperial powers, pitting countries against each other so that they can get the right support for themselves. For example, in Balfour Declaration, I don't know if you know why the Balfour Declaration came, but the Balfour Declaration was a quid pro quo. The Zionist movement, when they heard that the British and the French were in a weak position vis-a-vis Germany, and Germany had offered them truce in the First World War, the Zionist movement came to them and said, wait a minute, don't worry, we'll make you win this thing. You don't have to make a truce, you don't have to pull back. We can make you win against Germany, and we can do that by bringing the U.S. into the First World War. But in return, we want this little thing called Palestine. And we want it in public declarations from the British government and from the French government. So the French government issued what's called the Jules Cambon public declaration from then the foreign minister, Jules Cambon. And the British issued the Lord Balfour Declaration, who was the foreign minister then, in 1917. And this was part of the, and the negotiations for that are now available for those of you who are interested in this information as to why it happened, to see that indeed Brandeis and other Zionists in the U.S. pushed for the U.S. participation in the First World War when the U.S. was following more isolationist policies, did not want to interfere in European conflicts. But I digress now. To go back to the Palestinian popular resistance, having faced this incredible odds, basically, incredible situation, the amount of achievements that we have done is remarkable. Again, not unique in world history, but it's remarkable considering the level of challenge that we faced. For example, this is something I didn't know 2 years ago before I started compiling the information for this book. I didn't know about this history of this period in the 1880s and 1890s. They don't teach it to us, even Palestinians, in our history textbooks or schools or anything like that. They don't tell us that these gentlemen led nonviolent demonstrations in the 1880s and 1890s that finally convinced the Ottoman Sultan to abandon his support of the Zionist project. This is a remarkable achievement for nonviolent resistance and set the Zionist project perhaps at least 15 to 20 years, which may have been, by the way, critical. Because in the 19th century, colonization was more kosher, was more accepted. And by setting them back 15, 20 years, it may have been the key factor why Palestine is not going to be like Australia with the Aborigines. This may be a key thing to remember. So that's a positive thing. In fact, the Zionist movement moved its headquarters from mainland Europe to London, England, to work on the British, as I said, because they realized that they cannot get anything from the Ottoman Empire, so they should declare war on the Ottoman Empire and to support the British efforts on these things. And that's why the British, the Ottoman Empire, and the German Empire at the time. These nonviolent struggles continued year in, year out. When the British first came to Palestine to fulfill the Balfour Declaration obligations that they felt they needed to fulfill, they set up a Zionist to be High Commissioner of Palestine. His name was Herbert Samuel Lewis Herbert. And this guy was a Zionist. He was a member of the World Zionist Organization. He was a British citizen, but he was a member of the World Zionist Organization. They put him to be in charge of Palestine in 1920. And the Palestinians proceeded to have the first uprising in 1920-21. This uprising was a nonviolent uprising, a mass revolt, if you want, a mass uprising, just like the one I showed you in Egypt. And in Palestine, we have had many, many of those uprisings. This one, many Palestinians were killed, actually, but they were killed by British bullets. The Palestinians themselves did not fire bullets in this uprising. Palestinians continued to engage in nonviolent resistance, and I would say the era of the 1920s and 1930s, Palestinians became much more sophisticated in nonviolent resistance and even started innovating acts of nonviolent resistance that were not seen in other anti-colonial struggles. For example, these women led demonstrations in October 1929 that, to my knowledge, for the first time in human history, used cars in demonstrations. 120 cars beeping their horns down the streets of old streets of Jerusalem. This was a unique and interesting feature in 1929. Of course, not many cars, so obviously it was a spectacle. All the people gathered to see these cars going down the streets of Jerusalem. This woman also wrote letters to the editor in the London Times and other British magazines, and attempted to lobby the British Parliament. This, to my knowledge, is the first time that colonized people attempted to influence the policies of the colonizers through their mass media, from afar, you know, from a distance of 1,000 miles or more. So these are things that these people have done over the years. This woman here, Matia Al-Mughannam, in the white hat, wrote a book called The Arab Woman and the Palestine Problem, published in 1937, and still is a key feminist document for Arab women around the Middle East. Still inspires a lot of Arab women in their struggle for freedom and for equality. This is Matia Al-Mughannam again, among some religious leaders in Palestine, Muslim and Christian, leaders of nonviolent resistance. Many of these people, had the situation been different and the Western media not as much controlled by Zionists, would have been recognized as Mahatma Gandhi's or Martin Luther King equivalent in the Middle East. But of course, the Western media did not even know these people exist. And, you know, one of the handicaps of nonviolent resistance is you need the media, you need media coverage. Some of these people were killed, jailed, exiled. These are four Palestinian Muslims and two Palestinian Christians, leaders in a British jail in 1936 for engaging in nonviolent resistance. These things continued over the years. This is the staff of the Palestine Broadcast Corporation, the first radio in Palestine. And the guy in the middle was fired by the British from his position because his staff, and he refused to stop airing news stories about the nonviolent demonstrations that were happening in the 1930s and early 1940s in Palestine. And you know, I would love to actually get some sound bites, audio of these things, because I'm doing now a documentary on Palestinian nonviolent resistance. But for now, all I have is the records and the transcripts and the historical notes and, you know, memoirs of these people. You know, this is a situation in 1945 where this gentleman just returned after 8 years of exile for engaging in nonviolent resistance. You can see the Palestinian flag here, which was adopted by Palestinians in 1914 as the national flag of Palestine. You know, sometimes when I give talks like this at other places, there's usually the one or two obligatory right-wing Zionists who come with these glossy brochures, right? And their talking points. And they don't usually, I can watch from their body language, they're not really listening to what I say. They're just waiting very patiently till I finish so that they can read their talking points. And one time in one event, it was almost comical, very funny, and that's why I show this. One of them said, raised his hand and said, but Dr. Qumsiyya, you didn't explain to us why before 1965 there was no such thing as Palestine. That it came when the PLO was created by the Arab League. I'm like, were you listening to my talk? Did you attend my talk? You know. But anyways, the reality of it, of course, is we Palestinians have engaged in many, many different kinds of resistance over the years. You can read more details in my book. I won't belabor the issue. But the 1987-88 uprising was a very critical uprising for us and achieved a lot, like all the other uprisings. All uprisings achieved something. By the way, even though some of our current leaders say uprisings are harmful to the Palestinian cause, I disagree. I think any reading, rational reading of our history shows that any resistance, no matter what, is always useful. It's always useful because the status quo is certainly not useful. The status quo is not status quo in the sense that nothing happens. Status quo is that colonization intensifies, there's more ethnic cleansing, more homes demolished, more massacres of Palestinians, more of everything the colonizers that continue to do. Unlike the resistance which comes in waves, the colonizers do these things regardless of what happens around them. Sometimes, of course, they'll use excuses of wars and conflict to do more, but that's an excuse, and if there's no current excuses, they'll come up with an excuse themselves, including putting false flag operations, which happens regularly by the Israeli Mossad. But we Palestinians, of course, engage in nonviolent resistance in various methods. For example, by going to school when the Israeli authorities close the schools. This is one of my relatives teaching kindergarten. One, if they caught her doing this at that time, she would be jailed for 6 months because the kindergartens and all the schools were closed. At the time this happened, my own university, Bethlehem University, was closed for 2.5 years. Now imagine any university here being closed for 2.5 years. What would the people do? Well, they are not going to, if it's an unjust ruling, they are going to continue to go to school. But they will do it in people's homes, in basements, in churches, in mosques, and whatever they can get away with it, they'll do it. There's an American author by the name of Gene Sharp who says there are 199 forms of nonviolent resistance. He could have come up with one more, I'm sure. But I could have added one more for him, for example. In this uprising, the Palestinian flag was banned, okay? And you would get 9 months for showing the Palestinian flag. But the Palestinian flag was everywhere in Palestine to be seen in 1988. Why and how? It was in the laundry. People would hang their laundry with the colors of the Palestinian flag, all right? This is an innovative form of nonviolent resistance, right? So... So, yeah, there are some people who've been there and seen it. You know, everything you look at, you can look at it, the glass half empty or the glass half full, and you can look at the positive in everything. Even a horrific picture like this, I say to people, you can see the positive in it. This is just 2 years ago when Israel was committing massacres in Gaza. 1,400 Palestinians were butchered in a span of 3 weeks only. Most of them were civilians, including nearly 400 children. War crimes and crimes against humanity at an unprecedented level have not been committed in the last 20 years since then. And yet, the U.S., of course, said, well, Israel has the right to defend itself. Defend itself against what? You know, okay, some Palestinians shoot these homemade projectiles, not with explosive heads or anything, enough charge to lift it, and then it falls down. Of course, it can kill people, and there were a couple of Israelis who were killed before Israel committed these massacres in Gaza. But as Israel committed these massacres in Gaza, 1,400 people were butchered. In the same span, in 3 weeks, 13 Israelis were killed. 8 of them were soldiers, and it turned out that many of them were killed by friendly fire. So, you know, the ratio was more than 100 to 1, 200 to 1 or something, when you exclude the friendly fire incidents. So, you know, this is the reality. But again, you can look at these numbers, you can give these numbers, you can give these facts. But to me, even when they used white phosphorus here on a United Nations school in Gaza, what is the story of these people here that are running? What the ambulance driver, was he a school teacher here? Was he one of the people who took shelter in this school because they thought Israel would never bomb a United Nations school? What exactly is his story before this? What is exactly his story after this? What did he do after? Did he go back, treat the wounded, bury the dead? Did he go back, help paint, repaint the school? If he's a teacher, did he go back to teaching? These are the kinds of stories that I think are stories of inspiring popular resistance. And you're sure that the answer for the people there was all of the above, right? That these people were engaged in all of the above forms of nonviolent resistance. So even as horrific as these pictures may be with blood in the streets, you can think of the positive aspects of the Palestinians who are engaged in essentially nonviolent resistance. All of these pictures that I will show next basically are pictures of forms that show the courage, the persistence, the resilience of the Palestinian people, and why I am 100% certain that we will never fail in our quest for freedom, justice, and truth. These girls going to school, for example. These people literally climbing walls. These are forms of nonviolent resistance. This is last Palm Sunday when we tried to get into Jerusalem to go pray, because the tradition in Christianity is that we take palm leaves and we ride donkeys and mules, because Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey during Palm Sunday. And of course, Israel canceled this tradition after 1,500 years or 1,800 years of it functioning. Israel decided this will no longer happen. So the Palestinians, of course, decided to go ahead and try, and we went, and they started arresting us, including, by the way, they arrested this donkey and the mule and charged them with entering Jerusalem without a permit. These are two of my friends who were killed recently in nonviolent resistance, Basim Abu Rahma and his sister, Jawahir Abu Rahma, with tear gas canisters in the first case that crushed his chest, and in Jawahir's case by inhaling tear gas in the same demonstration almost a year later. You know, we in my village of Beit Sahur, Palestinian Center for Rapprochement, that Saeed and Jenka and others were involved in for a long time, is a center that led nonviolent resistance in Beit Sahur and was a pioneer in bringing internationals to Beit Sahur to join us in the nonviolent struggle. And we actually are now calling on the international community to send at least 1,000 internationals this summer, July 8 to 16. And we have some flyers that the French people did, because they are bringing 200 French who have already booked their tickets for that period. So we hope that this will be a very successful movement. The reason for that is, of course, Israel is more careful when internationals are around, watching over what we do. We will be doing land reclamation, peace-building efforts, but internationals can do much more if they choose to. Here are some internationals who managed to get into the Church of Nativity when it was being shelled, and I think the day they entered is the day the shelling stopped on the Church of Nativity. But of course, sometimes the Israelis will injure and kill internationals. This is Emily Henkowicz, an American student, 21 years old, came to visit with me, and then she told me she's a visual artist, she wants to document. I suggested she go to refugee camps and checkpoints to see what life for Palestinians are like. Unfortunately, at one of these checkpoints in Colombia, she was shot with rubber-coated steel bullets, and she lost her eye. This is Rachel Corey, who is 23 years old when she was crushed to death, and actually her family is still seeking justice for this deliberate murder that happened in Rafah nearly 8 years ago. Nine internationals were killed on this ship, the Mavi Marmara, as it tried to break the siege on Gaza. I'm going to skip. This is me here with obviously a Palestinian Christian family. This is Musa Abu Maria from Beit Umar. He's a Palestinian Muslim. This is Shai. He's an Israeli Jew. And this Israeli soldier with the barbed wire fence here enforcing Israeli apartheid law. This is not about religion. It's not about Jews versus Arabs or Israelis versus Palestinians or whatever. Here's even some Orthodox Jews with the sign that says, "Stop the Zionist terrorist massacre in Gaza." But by contrast, here are both Orthodox Jews and secular Jews who are celebrating as Gaza is bombed. And you can help us, obviously, with the boycott, divestments, and sanctions movement, a very important movement that's accelerating, as you heard also from Emily about the Sabeel leadership in the Kairos document and the Palestinian civil society call to action. Just like with South Africa, this is all very, very important things to do. So I will stop here and... obviously, we, like this little frog, are not going to give up. but we could use your help. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Kamsia. Thank you, Dr. Kamsia. I told you it was wonderful. And I'm sure you have lots of questions, and we'll be taking them in just a moment. And first, there's something I want to show you. If you'll just bear with me. Here we go. Here we go. Let's just get it full screen. Hey. Madison, did you unplug me?
It'll come, just wait a minute.
Okay, I see it here.
There it is.
There we go. So take a look. Have you seen this before? Okay, well, our organization, NorCal Sabeel, caused this very image to be up in 3 BART stations for a month recently. Thank you. And this is a grassroots, Hassan says, and it costs money. That's right. Yeah, that's kind of the point. You know, when we, I was going on a trip to Palestine, and everybody, you know, that in my life was saying, like, why are you going to such a dangerous place? Aren't you scared? Like those Palestinians are gonna, you know, hurt me. And a lot of people say, you know, I want to go to the Holy Land, but I'm just gonna go through this Jewish-Israeli group, and they're gonna take care of us, and we'll just zip over to Bethlehem for 45 minutes, so we won't have to meet any Palestinians. So this is something that we put together to try and contradict that, and I just feel like this is something that people need to see. So we're asking for your support tonight. I acknowledge, you know, we already, you know, you had your $10 donation at the door, but we're hoping to ask you to reach back into your pockets again, actually reach into your checkbook and write a check, because you should make it out to FOSNA, F-O-S-N-A, and that is tax deductible. So just think of a number, put that number in your head, and then double it, and then write a check for that amount. And here come the baskets right now. And what we're hoping to do is get this in not only into more BART stations, but also on the sides of buses, AC transit buses. And our big dream is a billboard. Don't you think this would be an awesome billboard? Okay, thanks. And then, the questions will start in just a minute, and we'll just pass the mic around for the questions. I was supposed to say something else. I was supposed to also let you know that this ad has been co-sponsored so far by American Muslims for Palestine. And going forward, it's going to be a cooperative effort with Mecca, Hassan, and Jewish Voice for Peace. Okay. Yay. Here, are you going to?
Emily mentioned, Dr. Kamsia will entertain a few questions. So we first want to take three questions from this side, and then we'll answer them, and then take three questions from this side. Assuming some of you have a lot of questions. Any question? Yes. Yes.
Get this off a website. I just don't know. I don't know what website to boycott products from Israel. I don't know main products that we should target.
Yeah. There's a list outside, but maybe Dr. Kamsia may have another additional information on that. Any other question?
What is the position of the Saudis in this struggle?
Position of what?
The Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia.
Saudi.
Oh, the المملكة العربية السعودية.
Okay.
Any question? Other question? Go ahead.
Firstly, thank you very much for your presentation. Secondly, the state of Israel is systematically put into place all the tools and apparatus that was used by the Germans when they did the same thing. The question is, how do the Palestinian people as a human being take it, you know, all this time of degrading them from what they're supposed to have? How do they go about in their day-to-day life, their physical, the mental, the emotional state of mind?
Okay, the reason I came up here is so that we leave the microphone roving down there and I can answer the questions from here. With regards to boycotts, the website that I put on my slide of boycotts is bdsmovement.net. It's a highly recommended website because it updates on current campaigns and events that are happening. As far as the position of the Saudi government, the royal family in Saudi Arabia is interested in one thing and one thing only, and that is the royal family in Saudi Arabia. And they really don't care about Palestine, Palestinians, Muslims, Islam, any of these things. As long as they are in power, they are happy to do whatever it takes. And so when it suits their interest to stay in power, to make rhetoric in support of Palestinians, or to drop a few million dollars here to build a couple of places for Palestinians, rebuild the refugee camp after it's leveled or something like that, then they will do it. But if the U.S. tells them, for example, that you have to support this or we will cut off our support for you, then they will change their minds. So there's no principled positions. It has to do only with the royal family interests, basically. As for the issue of day-to-day life in Palestine, how do we adapt to this thing? I'll tell you a story of another Sa'id. You will like this Sa'id. Not this Sa'id, but another Sa'id, Sa'id Abu Hijla. Sa'id Abu Hijla is a guy in Nablus who was shot himself when he was a teenager, just like this Sa'id. But he was shot in the belly. He did not get paralyzed. And he can show you his belly. Basically, half his intestines are gone. And then a few years later, they took him in. They tortured him. He almost died in prison. And then a couple of years later, they came, sprayed his house with machine guns, fire. He and his father and mother were on the balcony. They all got shot, basically, again. And his mother died instantly on the spot. So one time I was with Saeed in a car with an American journalist and an American politician, and we were driving, and the journalist said, "You know, Saeed, you are the most jovial, fun, joking guy I've ever met. You seem like you are very well adapted. If what happened to you happened to me, I would be crazy. I would be in a mental institution. How do you do it?" And Saeed did the following. He rolled down the window. He was driving down the streets of Nablus. I don't know how many of you have been in the streets of Nablus, very busy streets. He's driving. The three of us are in the car. And he rolled down the window. He stick his foot and his hand out the window. He lets go of the other hand of the wheel, uses both hands to wave to the cars that are passing. And the car is weaving like the middle of the road. And he says to Gail, "Who said we are not crazy?" So, you know, what can you do? You know, humans are interesting. Now, I don't claim that we are well adapted. I have my own family, just for the record. I have cousins who are not well adapted, who have turned to drugs, to alcohol, whatever. I have people I know, friends, who have committed suicide. There are people who are not adapted. There are people who are adapted. These struggles in humanity, of course, test us, test our will as human beings to survive. And some of us do well in it, and some of us don't do so well in these tests. But again, that's not special for us. I don't want to, again, you know, give you the impression that we Palestinians are special. I mean, in South Africa, under apartheid, similar things were happening. And the black South Africans, the majority of them survived it. The majority of them persisted. The majority of them held their chin high, kept their cool, kept their brains intact, didn't go crazy. So I think that's a good thing. And in the end, they succeeded. And some of them, of course, didn't. And some of them were killed. And, you know, we have so many martyrs. And we have to respect also that for the sake of these martyrs, we cannot accept Palestinians who are collaborators, who are just kind of giving up. You know, well, you know, what can we do? America is strong, Israel is strong, and we can't do anything about it. Nonsense. You know, there are much stronger empires in history that fell down, you know? So we should not, you know, give up on this, and that's what I tell my fellow Palestinians. Next.
Questions?
Dr. Kumsiya, I was hoping to hear about the current situation that we're having now of the last 2, 3, 4 weeks where there's been the bombings, as you know, and of the buses, near the buses, of the rockets that have left out of Gaza, mm-hmm. of the rocket that has come towards Tel Aviv. I'd like to know specifically how you feel this impacts the nonviolent struggle that you're engaged in, how it affects the legitimacy of nonviolent struggle, who's doing it, why they're doing it, and what can be done about this sort of non-productive struggle.
Good. Any other questions?
Dr. Kumsia, thank you. You're an academic. You taught in the U.S. You teach in Bethlehem, and you're calling for BDS. And you must be aware that, is it clear? You must be aware that many people find it in their heart to boycott products from Israel, from the occupied territories, to divest from Israel. But when it comes to academic and cultural boycott, they find themselves in a moral dilemma. I would like to get your position on this, if you can. Thank you.
Thanks. Another question, or shall I?
Another question?
From this side or this side? This gentleman here.
Please, one more.
Dr. Komsia, the boycotting movement seems to be against Israeli products. What about products of ultra-Zionists here in the United States who are doing everything to support the colonization of Palestine? And I think S.T. Lauder is maybe one such billionaire.
Thank you.
Okay. With regards to the current situation, the issue of the rockets and bombings, for example, there was a bombing in Jerusalem recently. Although, strangely enough, no Palestinian faction claimed responsibility for it. Usually Palestinian factions fight, you know, to immediately claim responsibility for anything they do and are very proud of it. So in this case, for some reason, no Palestinian faction stepped forward to claim responsibility, making it look very suspicious as to the origin of it. And considering the history of false flag operations that the Israeli Mossad have done over the years, decades really, including planting bombs in front of synagogues and mosques in Baghdad to scare Iraqi Jews into leaving into Palestine in the 1950s, and the Lavon affair in Egypt when they also put bombs and blamed them on Arabs in front of places like that. There was this incident with a settler family that was killed with a knife. They still don't know who did it, and there's some speculation about who did it and why they did it. There was even some talk among the settlers themselves. There may have been the Thai worker of the family who was disgruntled. We don't know what the real situation. But of course, Palestinians do engage in these kinds of violent actions. And I myself don't consider these kinds of actions helpful to our cause. In fact, they are very harmful to our cause, regardless of the motivation, how people do it. But we have to realize also, as a scientist, I can tell you that they are a natural phenomena that cannot be eliminated. There's always a bell-shaped curve of resistance, and the tail of it that's violent or extreme violent, as any statistician will tell you, even if you cut that tail, the curve will renormalize. What you have to do to stop all violence, whether that violence that's at the edge of the Palestinian curve, for example, or the much larger violence, which is 10 times, 100 more times, butchering of innocent civilians by the colonizers, occupiers, against the native Palestinians, another curve that's over it, those two curves, both of them are symptoms. They are not the underlying etiology. The underlying etiology is racism, apartheid, colonization, ethnic cleansing. These are the etiology of it. In South Africa, for example, the day apartheid ended is the day all forms of resistance ended, violent and nonviolent forms of resistance, and including the extreme forms of resistance in South Africa that were done claiming for resistance that you and I, of course, condemned. For example, in South Africa, they used to put rubber tires around people and burn them alive. Horrific things that were being done. But these were the symptoms of the problem, which was apartheid. That was the problem. That's what we should have focused, and that's what we should focus on. I was trying to show how we as Palestinians responded to this etiology, to this apartheid system. And the response has been largely 99.999% nonviolent response, as any, dispassionate, neutral person can testify if they just go look at the numbers. For example, look at how many Palestinians were engaged in armed resistance throughout the 62 years. And you take that by the total number of Palestinians who lived throughout these 62 years and who resisted by nonviolent methods, like by Sumud, by trying to stick to our land, by petitions, by civil disobedience, by tax revolts, by, demonstrations, all these things. And you will find that the numbers are always 99.99% nonviolent and a very tiny part that's violent. As to changing it, I don't know you can change it. To my knowledge, there's no anti-colonial struggle that was all violent or all non-violent. They were always a mixture, and that's just the reality. Now, some of us, of course, do try to change the behavior of others. I try to stop violence, for example, wherever I see it. And where I see it most is from the Israeli settlers and soldiers, and I try to stop it by non-violent methods. But also, if I see it among Palestinians, I try to stop it. I even took a full-page ad with Hanan Ashrawi and many other leading Palestinians one time against the violence in the form of suicide bombings in the 1990s. As for the issue of boycotts, academic and cultural boycotts, and some people shying away from that, what we have to do is educate them. Actually, the academic and cultural boycotts, in my humble opinion, are more important than the economic boycotts. In South Africa under apartheid, it was not the economic boycotts that made the difference. The gold mines, the diamond mines, all these things were humming and the business was as usual. Even companies that pulled from South Africa managed to find ways to continue doing business as usual behind the scenes so that people don't see them. It was the cultural and academic boycott and boycott of South Africans coming to Europe and not to North America that finally made white South African elites who could travel, who could come to America or the Europeans to change their views. Because before that, they were welcomed with open arms. And they were welcomed as members of Europe. They thought of themselves as Europeans. They thought of themselves as Democrats. They said, we're the only democracy in Africa. Of course, they were a democracy for white people, just like Israel says, we're the only democracy in the Middle East. Well, you're not the only democracy, but you're a democracy for white people. There's, of course, Lebanon and Turkey are democracies. Israel is not a democracy. Israel is a democracy for Jews. It's not a democracy for non-Jews that live in the state or that were ethnically cleansed to make the state more pure, so to speak. So when these people come to Europe and North America, whether South African white apartheid supporters or Israeli apartheid supporters, they should be faced with signs that says boycott apartheid, free South Africa or free Palestine. And that would make them think and turn back and have to rethink their life in those areas. In the case of white South Africans, they realize if the Europeans are rejecting us, why, maybe it's us. Maybe we need to rethink what we are doing. And they went back and started to rethink what they were doing. So that's why it's important. It's a critical tool for rethinking. It's also a great educational tool because let's say you have a professor coming to university and you have a group of students and faculty who refuse to attend his lecture because he comes from an Israeli university that's built on stolen Palestinian land and that supports the military in Israel. That's what all Israeli universities do. Then it makes people to start and question, why are they boycotting this guy? And then you have an opportunity to explain to them. So it's a great educational tool, and it's been growing. And the best evidence of its success is how the Israeli government is reacting to it. The fact that they set up a high-level ministerial committee to deal with BDS. They haven't set a high-level ministerial committee to deal with Iran, which they call
this grave threat in the Middle East. So why are they setting a high-level ministerial committee to deal with BDS? Because they know how effective it is. They know how important it is. And they also started with laws in the Knesset, the recent law that's going to punish Israeli Jewish citizens even who call for boycotts. So free speech in Israel is down the drain now with these laws, draconian laws that are coming. So as far as which products to boycott, well, if you go to that same website, bdsmovement.net, you will see a lot of campaigns, for example, against Caterpillar and Motorola now is very good campaigns, strong campaigns. There's a campaign for TIA Cref, for those of you like me who are in the academia, which can be very important to divest from Israeli products. There are many U.S. States, and I don't know about California, invest in Israeli bonds, which in my humble opinion is junk bonds and should not be invested in, even strictly on investment criteria. They don't certainly return as much as investment in bonds of other countries or in good deals in other countries. But they are done for political purposes, and those should be pressured to be divested from and boycotted. So there are companies to boycott that profit from the occupation in many different levels of the U.S. society. The tear gas that killed Jawahar Abu Rahma is made in Erie, Pennsylvania, believe it or not. You know, the bulldozer Caterpillar that killed Rachel Corrie is made in the U.S. specifically for Israel, no other country. They make these armored bulldozers just to support Israel. Caterpillar is a company that should be shamed because they are supporting war crimes and crimes against humanity.
We have time questions? For a couple more questions.
Thank you, Dr. Kumsia, for your work and your educational and inspirational presentation. I have more of a comment than a question. You talked about nonviolent resistance being something like it's not popular with the media, I think. I think it's also not profit, not good for profit. And maybe if nonviolent resistance was made profitable, although I don't think that's a good idea either, it would become more supported. I'm wondering if you have any comments about that.
Thank you so much for coming to the United States to share your understanding of the situation and educate us. I wanted to ask two things, Dr. Kumsia. One, for you to comment about the, I believe it was a recent expulsion of the leader of the Anglican Church in Jerusalem, and also the recent Vatican Synod that put Israel on notice. Thank you.
And the last question? We could take two more questions. Go ahead.
I was wondering what to say to my Jewish friends about the effect of the occupation on Israel. If you have a couple of words on that, please.
Last one?
Okay.
Okay, I just wanted to ask you about the tear gas. It seems to some of us old folks who experienced tear gas when we were in Palestine that it's qualitatively different from what we experienced at UC Berkeley in the 60s. I just wondered if you knew anything about that.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. I'll try to be brief. In terms of the issue of the media, of course, media, the word media refers to communication to other people with information. And media is a very vast subject. And, you know, there is, of course, the mainstream media like newspapers in the U.S. or cable TV, CNN, Fox News, etc. But there's also the alternative media outlets, and certainly also nowadays the internet, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, all these things that are spreading information. These are all media outlets. And actually, increasingly, the mainstream media has become less and less relevant, and the alternative media, and especially the new media, so to speak, the technologically savvy media, is what's taking sway among the public. And this is very good for us. It's in our advantage, and will continue to grow. When some of you signed my own email list, for example, that was just passed around, and feel free to sign if you didn't, you'll be added to our email list, which goes to 50,000 people. And this is just little old me doing lectures and talks and collecting emails as I go along. So, and there are people who are much more savvy than I am in using Facebook and other things, and I need to learn more from them. So I am very optimistic that these changes in the media landscape, if you want, are going to be advantageous to us in accelerating what is eventually an inevitable demise of this colonial Zionist venture. As to what is happening with the bishop in Jerusalem, who was basically denied his residency rights in Jerusalem, yes, Israel is becoming an increasingly a fascist state, and is thrashing around with fascist resolutions one after another. Just in the Knesset in the last 2 months, something like 6 bills were passed that that are racist in nature. This happens. This is actually encouraging to me, believe it or not, because it happens in the end of every colonial venture. Every colonial venture, towards the end, they get very crazy. And so I always look at the glass half full. I always see the positive in things, and that's maybe an illness that I have. So I think they are thrashing around. They don't know what to do. You know, they introduce these resolutions and these things that are not going to really affect. I mean, is this bishop going to stop preaching? Even if he does it by video conference in Jerusalem, he will do it. You know, it is not going to stop what people are doing. When they, for example, issued the new resolution in the Knesset that says Palestinians from Jerusalem cannot hold tour guide licenses. Well, you know, in effect, this law did not change anything, because already the Israeli tourist ministry did not issue by just simply denying them. But now they had the law, so people could point at the law. But in fact, this is not going to decrease anything or change anything on the ground. Palestinian tour operators still do it without approval from the Israelis. I know many of them. And they still will continue to do our business as usual. So putting additional racist laws makes them feel better as Zionists, because it makes them feel that they are doing something when they know that the carpet is being pulled from under them and that this house of cards that they have built is collapsing. So I think this is an indication of that. The effect of the occupation on Israel is a very critical subject, and I urge people to actually investigate this in terms of what the effect on the average Israeli people, individuals, because while the Israeli leaders claim what they are doing is for the benefit of Israelis, the reality is it harms Israelis. Israel now is not safe country. Israelis are not safe and will not be safe. In fact, any other country is more safe for Jews than Israel is. And this is a failure of Zionism, because it's built on repression, and repression can never bring safety. On any other front you look at in Israel, it's a failure. Let's take, for example, poverty rates. Why is 40% of Israeli children live below the poverty line, when Israel has a GDP that's similar to European countries? Why is that? Why is it that they are building this $8 billion wall inside the West Bank that is profiting speculators in land and others who will take over the Palestinian lands, but certainly not helping the middle class in Israel? Israel claims it did this because of the Jews in the Holocaust, all this stuff. And yet there are demonstrations in front of the Knesset regularly by Holocaust survivors who want a $20 raise in their salaries that are basically not enough for them to live on. When Israel got billions of dollars, billions literally, from Germany, supposedly for these Holocaust survivors. These Holocaust survivors are not getting the money. So why is the Israeli government allowed to use their money? These are things that we have to challenge Israel on. There's a lot of these facts available on the internet. You can research them. As far as the tear gas is concerned, yes, Israel is using modified tear gas with various material in it. Some of it was investigated. Some of it still pending additional investigation. I know of at least two studies, one in Italy and one in England, that were done on chemicals that Israel used. One that I personally was subjected to, a tear gas that I once got exposed to, I came to the U.S. actually the next day after the demonstration. And for 2 weeks here in the U.S., I had hives all over my body, my skin. That had nothing to do with, of course, tear gas that's supposed to be a temporary inconvenience for the lungs and the heart. And the breathing and the tears of the eyes, etc. So, and I had to go on intensive steroid injections to reduce this. So obviously they were using stuff, and some of it, as I said, was investigated. We know those chemicals. I can't name them now off the top of my head there. But if you email me, I'll be happy to send you the articles and the information on these chemicals that were analyzed in laboratories in Britain and in Italy. I do want to thank you for coming, for listening so intensely. As I said, sign the email list if you want to stay in touch with us. I'd be happy to hang around, sign some books. I'll be down here. And while signing books, I can also talk at the same time. So if you have more questions, I'm more than happy to talk. Thank you.